I want to welcome you to our discussion this afternoon on religion as a factor in the conflicts in the Middle East. I'm David Smock from the U.S. Institute of Peace, and I want to welcome you on behalf of my colleagues here at the Institute for what we hope will be an informative discussion of this important topic. Please turn off your cell phones before anything else to make sure there are no interruptions during the presentations. Religion is frequently cited as a major factor in a variety of the conflicts in the Middle East. And this afternoon we want to assess the extent to which that's a legitimate and justified characterization, the extent to which religion is a significant factor. We can fairly easily move around the region and identify the kinds of conflicts that exist based upon differences in religion and religious identity. Even looking at Israel, there are conflicts between secular and religious Jews, tension between Orthodox and other branches of Judaism, the other branches not being officially recognized in Israel. The religious convictions on the part of the religious right in Israel that all biblical Israel must be controlled by Israel, which leaves no place for the Palestinians. Conflict between Jews and the Israeli Arab population, both Christians and Muslims, over whether Israel should be a Jewish state, a position that is shared with some Israeli Jews as well. And finally, there is the Christian element represented by the Christian embassy in Jerusalem, the headquarters for Christian Zionists who advocate the control of all of biblical Israel by the state of Israel as a precursor to the end times, although they don't often say that the Jews will be lost in the rapture when the end times come. In Egypt, some have characterized increasing tensions between Muslim Egyptians and the Coptic, significant Coptic Christian population. The political ethos in Egypt is to discourage discussion of religious differences, as if the mere discussion of the differences would be a threat to national unity. But the religious division is real, and in some respects is increasing. There are the Sunni and Shia divisions in several of the Gulf states. Shiite Iran versus Arab Sunnis in competition for dominance in the region. We all know the sharp Sunni-Shia divisions within Iraq. And the emergence of the Shiite majority in Iraq and the impact of this on other divided societies in the Middle East. And the impact of the Hezbollah actions against Israel recently, the impact on Shia-Sunni relations and on the balance of power between Sunnis and Shias. And Graham Fuller will be discussing the whole issue of Sunni-Shia relationships in the region. In Syria, the Alawite minority, which holds many positions of political power over against the more dominant, in population terms, Sunni majority. And there are Muslim-Christian relations in countries beyond Egypt, among the Christian and Muslim populations within the Palestinian territories. And in Lebanon, both Daoud and Imad will be addressing the delicate and complicated confessional balance in Lebanon. And in Jordan, where there's been a great deal of attention given to interfaith relations between Christians and Muslims. And in Iraq, a small Christian minority, with many of the Christians fleeing the country in the state of current conflict, and other countries. But what does it mean to say that religion is a critical factor in Middle Eastern politics? In pointing out the tension and conflicts between the various religious communities in the Middle East is not to say that differences in religious beliefs are the principal source of tension. Religious belief and practice are generally not the principal sources of division and tension. in some cases, religious belief is predominant in the differences between religious groups. But religion, more importantly, is a source of social identity. Identity that has its own symbols, history, and culture, which may or may not be directly related to religion and religious convictions. This is certainly the case in Iraq. We talk about the three principal constituent communities being the Sunnis, the Shia, and the Kurds. But the Sunnis and Shia are religious identities, and the Kurdish identity, most of the Kurds being Sunnis, but some being Shia, being an ethnic identity. So we treat the religious division between Sunnis and Shias to be comparable between the ethnic division between Kurds and Sunnis and Shias. When religion and ethnic or national identity overlap, this only deepens the divisions, as is the case with Iran, for instance. The Iranians are differentiated from most Arabs both by their religious identity as Shia, and their ethnic identity is defined by their language and culture. In this sense, the emphasis upon religious difference is often exaggerated, in that the difference between religious communities is frequently not primarily one between religious beliefs and convictions. We obviously, in 2 hours, can't cover the whole range of religious issues in the Middle East, but we have three presenters, and I've indicated the kinds of things that they will be addressing in their presentations. Daoud and Imad will be talking about, Imad particularly, be talking about the confessional system and religious relations in Lebanon. Daoud will talk about the religious roots and orientation of Hezbollah. And Graham will talk about the Shia-Sunni division in the region and also talk about the religious orientation and roots of Hamas. And after their presentations, I will say something about interfaith dialogue and interfaith communication in the Middle East. Our first presenter will be Daoud Kerala, who is an adjunct professor of law at Georgetown University and has also held a similar position at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. He was deputy general counsel for 5 years at the World Bank and deputy general counsel at the International Finance Corporation. He has published on the confessional system in Lebanon. He graduated from Lebanese University and received law degrees from the University of Michigan. Daoud?
Thank you. Hezbollah is the largest and most prominent political party in Lebanon. It is probably the most renowned Islamist organization also. Dismissing Hezbollah as a terrorist organization doesn't help anyone. It is much more than a well-armed, well-trained, well-motivated militia. Hezbollah represents the largest community in Lebanon and acts as an umbrella for a wide network of social activities in the country. What I plan to do, since I was asked to limit my remarks to the religious and political dimensions that brought about, that led to the emergence of Hezbollah, I will do that, and anything that you might be interested in knowing about relationship between Hezbollah and the government and the latest flare-up, I'll be glad to handle during the question and answer period. In talking about the factors that led to the establishment, to the creation of Hezbollah, I will start with the background that led to the mobilization of the Shia community. The Shias are, or were basically, rural dwellers. They dwelled in the south of Lebanon, mostly, and in the Bekaa Valley, until the 60s. In the 60s, during the 1960s, they started moving to Beirut, and they were the most disadvantaged of the Lebanese communities, in a sense. Their exposure to the affluent lifestyle, Western lifestyle, of the Christians and Sunni communities in Beirut has engendered a sense of deprivation. And they called themselves the proletariat of Lebanon. The Shia felt that they were underrepresented in the government, in parliament, in civil service, and in the executive branch of the government, because they felt that, because actually this is the case, that the representation in government reflects demographics that date back to 1932, where under the French mandate there was a census, and this census still played the basic role until the Civil War about the representation in government. So this has created two things: a sense of alienation on the part of the Shiite, and at the same time, some kind of delegitimizing the government. Now, although such conditions would usually lead to adopting religion as a replacement mechanism, the political mobilization of the Shiites first found secular avenues. They joined mostly Arab nationalist movements, such as the Ba'ath parties, the Nasserites, and other movements like the Syrian Social National Parties, and many leftist and communist, the Lebanese Communist Parties, and the Organization of Communist Actions that was headed by a Shiite, and most of its membership were Shiites. Now, when we think of this affiliation, we shouldn't assume that it is the secular nature of these organizations that have led to, that were appealing to the Shiites. In fact, there was no communal organization, no communal party, no religious parties that represented them. This was the case until Musa Sadr, who is a very charismatic Shia cleric, came and started a movement in 1974, the movement of the deprived, Harakat Mahrumin. A year after that, in 1975, he established Amal. It's the militia branch of this movement. When the civil war started, we're talking about 1975-76, the Sadr movement was, in a sense, sidestep. And many of the Amal defected to the national socialist movements. Of all the sectarian groups, the civil war has taken the largest toll from the Shiites. At the beginning of the war, the eviction of 100,000 people from the Naba area, this is the belt of misery around Beirut, has left quite an impact on the Shia communities. Amal, however, saw an upsurge in popularity after the disappearance of of al-Sadr and an Islamic revolution in Iran a year after. Now, the communal politicization of the Shiite preceded their political or religious politicization. Their political awakening had more in common with other Lebanese sects than with universal Islamic awakening. Now, there are two important factors that I would like to address. First, the Israeli invasion of 1982 had a very important impact. The Israeli invasion of 82 was a preeminent factor in the birth of Hezbollah, and hence the Islamization of the Shiite resistance. The process of the Shiite radicalization had started with the first Israeli invasion in 1978, but the mass destruction and the brutality in 1982 had a very serious subsequent effect on the powers that eventually came about to be known as the Shiite resistance. The Israeli attacks and incursions go back to 1968, which the PLO began establishing bases in South Lebanon. Israel's actual occupation of a part of the South, it is so-called security zone, began a decade later in the aftermath of the Litani operation, which resulted in 2,000 dead and about 250,000 disappeared. The intersection, this invasion and the occupation that ensued did not lead to active resistance on the part of the Shiite. The hegemony of the PLO over the southern battlefield preceded the emergence of the Lebanese resistance. The emergence of Hezbollah, first, the religious and political origin of the Shiite movement and the emergence of Hezbollah were due to two factors. In 1982, the Israeli invasion of Lebanon and the political mobilization of the Shia community. The mobilization of the Shia community. They were ruler dwellers until the 1960s. They moved to the suburbs and constituted a belt of misery, most devastated. So the Shiite Islamic Resistance Group coalesced to form Hezbollah. The Israeli attacks go back to 1968. Sorry, the religious and political origins of Hezbollah. The emergence of Hezbollah was due to two factors: the Israeli invasion and the political mobilization of the Shia community. The Shiite Islamic resistance groups that accelerated to form Hezbollah. Israeli attacks increased. Go back to 1968 when the PLO began establishing bases in South Lebanon. Israel's actual occupation of a part of the South, its so-called security zone, began a decade later in the aftermath of the Litani operation, which resulted in 2,000 dead and 250,000 displaced. Intersecting this invasion and the occupation that ensued did not lead to active resistance on the part of the Shiite. The hegemony of the PLO over the southern battlefield precluded the emergence of the Lebanese resistance. It was Israel's success in eradicating the armed Palestinian presence in Lebanon in 1982 that permitted other resistance groups to come to the fore. Another factor that may explain the Shiite non-resistance in 1978 was that Islamic revolution in Iran had not taken place. The
Mm-hmm. Want Ram to go first, and then you find
yourself. Well, yes, let's do that.
We'll come back to Daoud to complete his presentation. Our next presenter is Graham Fuller, who was previously vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA and was later at the RAND Corporation. He's published extensively on the Middle East and religion, including The Future of Political Islam and The Arab Shia, The Forgotten Muslims, which he wrote jointly with Ren Franke, supported by a grant from USIP. He also authored a USIP special report entitled Islamist Politics in Iraq After Saddam Hussein. Graham is currently resident in Vancouver, British Columbia, where he's adjunct professor at Simon Fraser University.
Thank you, David. It's a pleasure being back in my old hometown of Washington. I don't miss the summers here, but there are lots of old friends. I've been at, well, the subject of today's seminar, as you know, is the religious dimensions of conflict in the Middle East. But I'd like to put a question to you, for starters. What if there was no such thing as Islam? What would the state of the Middle East be today? Would Arabs and Persians feel happy about present conditions there? would Western or U.S. relations with the Middle East be entirely different? For example, would there have been no dissatisfaction in that part of the world with European colonial domination for a century or more? Would the European division of traditional Muslim lands according to European convenience and colonial interests, would that have been a satisfactory situation for the inhabitants of the area? Would a Western desire to exploit and dominate Middle Eastern markets and oil, would that have been acceptable to citizens of the Middle East? Would the use of the Middle East as a staging point for Western global politics, imperial politics, World War I, World War II, and the Cold War, the use of the Middle East for European benefit in all these areas, would that have been acceptable and desirable in Middle Easterners' eyes? Would the region have felt differently about the creation of the State of Israel as essentially a Western project in what had been basically Islamic-dominated lands? And would the publics in that part of the world today feel differently about oppressive, illegitimate Muslim rulers who dominate the region today? I mention all of this simply to suggest that there is more going on here than Islam and Islamic culture or even Islamic history. That there are certain basic geopolitical factors which have had huge impact on the region. The religious element, indeed, has exacerbated and developed and intensified many of these feelings, but they are based on some quite solid geopolitical and historical and developments. Now, let me say, too, that I've been through years in CIA and Rand Corporation and other such places, I'm increasingly struck these days by two huge contradictions in the way America thinks about the rest of the world. And this is quite relevant to the Middle East and our interpretation and analysis of this. On the one hand, we are delighted at being the world's sole superpower, and many have quite openly relished that position since the collapse of the Soviet Union. And yet, on the other hand, even though we are the sole global superpower, we somehow believe that what the U.S. does or does not do in the region is really not particularly important. Analysis after analysis after analysis within government and in U.S. think tanks ignore the role of the United States, positive or negative, but let's say particularly negative, but just the role of the U.S., the American footprint, as the Pentagon tellingly likes to call it. We can't have it both ways. If we are the world's sole global superpower, we are going to have huge impact on the way people in the region perceive the United States and our policies. And if we prefer to think otherwise of some kind of immaculate American policies in the region that don't have impact, then I would argue that we are not then the sole global superpower. We can't have it both ways. We need to think about that. And all of this is by way of a cautionary remarks about not overemphasizing the role of religion alone in as the root of these conflicts. And indeed, David Smock began the session today by giving us such a warning that despite religious elements, there is a great deal much else to be talked about. And he mentioned a key point that I want to also mention, is that we're not talking about religion and theology among these groups so much, but the fact that the Middle East, as it historically developed, was along lines of religious communities. Much of this is a legacy of the Ottoman Empire, but even before then. We're talking essentially about communities and communities getting along or not getting along with each other, much as not exactly parallel, but if we look at the history of the United States and bad feeling between Protestant and Catholic communities, which were quite serious. Some of you may even remember that there was serious doubt about JFK's candidacy 30 years ago or more, because there was fear that this would bring Catholic influence into the White House and perhaps the Pope's influence. There has been a lot of anti-Catholic feeling historically in this country. So when it wasn't that particularly theology, but the weight of communities that has raised the issues on different sides. Now, as I look now at the question that I was directly asked to look at, the Shiite and Sunni differences and what they mean, I think we need to think about not what are the divisions between communities, because we can talk all day about divisions between communities, but when these divisions become operative. We all have multiple identities. People in the Middle East have multiple identities, as David had talked about earlier. You can be Sunni, you can be Shiite, you can be Iraqi, you're a Muslim, you're all of these different things. You're a businessman or a worker, or you're a socialist or an Islamist. We have all the. What is it that makes one identity at any one given point more important than another given identity? Today, particularly in Iraq, we're at a point where where the sectarian identity happens to be right now absolutely dominant, to the point of life or death questions. Now, quickly, what are some of the preconditions and factors that lead differences between Sunni and Shiites at this point to be emphasized? Well, first of all, look at any community where the Shiite community is a very large one and contesting for power, and you will see frictions. This is normal. Different groups will contest for political power. So Iraq, Bahrain, which we all forget about, but is a country in which a quite small, a minority of Sunnis rule over a large Shiite majority, as in Iraq, but even more so. And in Lebanon, where we have a significant balance, or significant minorities, such as in Kuwait or Syria, or even Pakistan. But these are the areas where these minorities and majorities are particularly in a struggle for power and when Shia have been excluded. So that's one. Secondly, Shiite power in the past decades has been very revolutionary in character. As Daoud was earlier saying, they were at the bottom of the heap in Lebanon, and they have suddenly risen up to the top on both the demographic basis and on the basis of their self-organization. Revolution in Iran has had hugely important impact. Yes, it was on the basis of Shiism and Shiite clerical power, among other things, but it also had resonance in the Muslim world. The rest of the Muslim world. So Shiite assertion has been very important element in causing Sunni concern. Let me point out, though, that when the Shia came to power when the clerics came to power with the Islamic Revolution in Iran, they supported traditional Arab causes and Palestine and the Islamic causes widely. It was not a defense of Shiite causes, but Islamic causes. Similarly, in Lebanon, Hezbollah today is speaking in the language of Arab nationalism as well as Islam, not Shiism, but Islam, and the broader issues of Islam. When Shiites stand up and defy the West in Iran or in Lebanon, this has brought this act of assertion has both brought fear to ruling regimes and at the same time inspired Arab populations who themselves are looking for a hero who will stand up to the West. Shiites have gained from democratization as well, as we've talked about in Lebanon and in Iraq now, and we will probably see elsewhere. This has raised the intensity of struggle with the Sunnis to some extent. Hardline Salafi clerics in the Muslim world are very concerned with the rise of Shiite power. But I emphasize, these are hard-line Salafis, not your average Islamic cleric, Shiite cleric, is going to be that unhappy about it. I point to the fact that just recently, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt openly embraced Hezbollah as fighting in the same cause that the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt believe in. The Muslim Brotherhood is the granddaddy, the grandfather of all Islamist movements in the Arab world, and they openly embraced this. Even Al-Qaeda was forced to acknowledge that from their point of view, Hezbollah was fighting for a similar sort of cause and could not be condemned. Typically, in an Arab-Persian conflict, when we have an ethnic conflict here, yes, again, we will find concern over Shiites, but as David also had pointed out earlier, it's because the Shiite-Sunni fault line coincides at that point with much of the Arab-Persian ethnic one. And finally, when you have, as we do have in Iraq today, international jihadist forces killing indiscriminately large numbers of Shiites, and Shiite then death squads responding, naturally we find an immense exacerbation of the Shiite-Sunni conflict. But if it were not for these jihadist organizations, who probably hate Shiites as much as they do the West, I'm talking about the really extreme ones now, if it were not for these organizations, we would not find the same degree of intense struggle between them. Now, very quickly, let me just turn to the case for Shiite loyalty or solidarity with Islamists. I've touched on some of them, with Sunni Islamists. I've touched on some of this already in earlier moments. But we had, for example, in the 10th to the 12th century, a truly glorious moment in Islamic history with the Fatimid dynasty. Shiite dynasty spoke in the name of the Arab cause. The Islamic cause was seen to be a great moment in the history of the region. The Alawite regime in Syria, a minority regime, 12, 13, 14% of the population, basically Shiite in character, although a heterogeneous type of heterodox type of Shiism. The Alawis in Syria have been honorary Sunnis in all respects when it comes to their international politics. They've stood, for better or for worse, fully behind the Arab struggle, the struggle against Israel, fought wars, and been deeply involved in Arab political issues. They have not been a marginal Shiite issue. Shiite clerics in Iran, going back to the 19th century, have fought against British imperialism very powerfully in ways that were respected in the Sunni world. And today, indeed, the Shiite clerics in Iran are increasingly speaking out against American occupation and American imperialism. This is quite distinct from the Shah, who cared very little about Islamic causes or Arab politics at all, and spoke mainly in the name of Persian nationalism. So here, the clerics in Iran, the Shiite clerics, are more Sunni, if you will, than the Shah had ever been. I mentioned the Iranian Revolution when Khomeini spoke out fully in support of issues that were of importance to Sunni Arabs. And Hezbollah now is being broadly recognized across the Muslim world as standing up for rights that the rest of the Sunnis believe in. They want to see revolutionary power and assertiveness and boldness and braveness and a willingness to stand up to Israel, and they're getting it not from Sunnis but from Shiites. At the popular level, not the regime, the regimes are quivering in their boots, but the popular level, there is great support for this. So I conclude from this that for the U.S. or any power to sort of play in one of these simple games of Sunni good, Shiite bad, which was the motto at the time of the Islamic Revolution, and now it's been reversed, where it's Shiite good, Sunni bad. Neither of these formulations is really going to work, and they're very sloppy. The both Sunnis and Shia have in the past and will again in the future find common cause on lots and lots of issues. So the biggest fault line perhaps today, at least in today's politics, is not between Sunni and Shiites, but between the rulers and the ruled in the Middle East. The rulers who fear revolutionary, democratizing, bold, stand up and tell it like it is powers, and the masses who love that. And that's where the biggest split lies, except, as I mentioned, for these other cases where you have traditional communitarian struggles, Iraq, Bahrain, Lebanon, or jihadist killings. Now, finally, let me make one final concluding remarks about Hamas that David asked me to talk about. Yet another interesting perspective on the role of religion. We all think of Hamas, of course, as ultra-Orthodox, struggling for against Israel, the liberation campaigns, very much part of the contemporary Middle East struggle. But if we look at the origin of all of this, it's not quite that way. The Hamas has had good working relationships with Shiite Hezbollah for a very long time. The Muslim Brotherhood has never had major problems with the Shia or with particularly with Hezbollah. If we look at the historical record, as a matter of fact, Hamas, which grew out of the Muslim Brotherhood, which began in Egypt but then had branches in Jordan and Palestine and elsewhere, the Muslim Brotherhood for years and years was actually hostile to Arab nationalism. It feared Arab nationalism, it feared communism, it feared the leftist tendencies among Arab nationalists, and actually was willing to fight against them. It was anti-Fatah, for example, for a very long period of time. Israel and the United States encouraged Hamas at various times as a way to combat the power of the PLO and Fatah. This was a mistake that Rabin later admitted to Arafat as being one of the greatest mistakes that Israel had ever made. There were training camps for Hamas and other Islamic leadership, other Islamist groups, to bring guerrilla warfare against the Assad regime in Syria at a time when the United States perceived Syria as an ally of the Soviet Union. And remember, the PLO and Christian Palestinians were engaged in an armed struggle against Israel long before Hamas ever came onto the scene to do this. It was only when Hamas perceived, after the beginning of the Intifada, that the Intifada was going on ahead as a secular and even with Christian support among Palestinians, that they recognized that they better get into the game if they were not to be totally left behind. So think about this. Hamas came on very late into this game of armed struggle against Israel and being willing to cooperate with Arab nationalism. Today, we tend to forget those facts. So what, again, I'm pointing out here is these seemingly tight categories that we all love to embrace about Shiite and Sunni and who gets along and who fights in what name have shifted dramatically over the years. I will conclude now. Time is running out. But I just want to emphasize again, we see a merging of Islamism with nationalism across great parts of the Middle East. This is what makes it particularly difficult for the U.S. to take on warfare against either one or the other element, or to simply select one group as a temporary ally at convenience among others. If Washington is going to base its geopolitical policies on a Sunni-Shiite split, I would argue this is truly a lazy man's geopolitical touchstone of convenience at the moment, but will not be a successful guide to trying to manage the multiple forces that are operative today in the Middle East. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Graham. Our final presenter is Imad Harb, who is a senior program officer here at USIP in the Institute's education program. Previously, he taught at Georgetown University. He's taught at George Washington University and University of Maryland. He received his PhD from the University of Maryland, and he's published on the confessional system in Lebanon, and that's what he's going to talk to us today about.
Good afternoon. Just a little bit of correction. I didn't get my PhD from Maryland. I got it from Utah, out west. And it was a good PhD, too. It's an honor to join this distinguished panel this afternoon to talk about Lebanon's confessional and political makeup. You know, when we start talking about Lebanon's confessional and political makeup, we might as well sit for a while. And I'll try to limit my remarks to my allotted time. I first would like to chart a little bit the Lebanese confessional political system, so to speak, and then talk a little bit about a possibility, just very, very briefly, about possibilities of what needs to be happen for this country to find its civic peace that it so well deserves. First of all, many of you know that Lebanon is a mosaic of different religious communities, and also a huge, large, humongous community called secularists. They don't necessarily really claim any confessional belonging. On the Christian side, you have the Maronites, the Greek Orthodox and Catholics, the Armenian Orthodox, otherwise known as the Gregorians, and the Armenian Catholics. The Syrian Orthodox, known as the Jacobites, and the Catholics, the Nestorian Assyrians, the Roman Catholics, also known as the Latins, the Chaldeans, and the Protestants, and actually some other ones like Anglicans. On the Muslim side, we have the Sunni Muslims and the Sunni Shia. We have the Druze, we have the Ismailis, and some Alawis. Actually, the Alawis are probably they were the last religious minority to be accorded official status in Lebanon, the 18th, that is. Although there are the Jews are considered to be an independent religious group, there's hardly any Jews in Lebanon, unfortunately, and there is a very small contingent of Baha'is in Lebanon. Over the last century or so, actually much more than the last century, but dating back to the middle 19th century, Lebanon's political formula has been a confessional political formula. It's the agreement between different religious communities that they would like to exist together in some sort of a condominium, a political religious condominium. That formula later on, as a political scientist, I'd like to always go back to my political science degree, the PhD I got from Utah, the formula basically is known as consociationalism, big word, but it basically means political arrangement that is being used today in many very successful cases, like in Europe, in Belgium, the Netherlands, places like that. In Cyprus, they used consociationalism, and for a while it succeeded, like the Lebanese case, but later on it had its trouble. According to the basic formula of this consociational politics, there are basically four basic principles that govern political relations and basically define this concept. The first one is basically proportional representation according to the number of different communities. In the Lebanese case, obviously, it is it's religious communities. And as Dawood pointed out earlier, the last census in Lebanon was done in 1932 when the Christians held a slight majority over Muslims. And among the Christians, the Maronite community represented the majority, so they had basically a plurality. And thus, in 1943, when Lebanon received its independence from France, the Maronites got the presidency of the republic. The Sunnis, who were the second plurality, formed the second plurality got the prime minister's office, and the Shia, the third, got the speakership of parliament. As a matter of fact, this political formula went all the way down the political ladder, so to speak, to basically like today, the chief of staff of the Lebanese army is a Druze. The deputy speaker of parliament is a Greek Orthodox, and so they gave every community a little bit of a little piece of the political pie to make this formula possible and successful, and to basically plan for the second principle of consociationalism, which is a grand coalition, a grand coalition between these different communities that all agree on what is right and what is good for this country. What's good for everybody is good for what's good for one is good for all. This grand coalition really survived for a long, long time, and between 43 and 75, it went through some rough times until finally in 1975. Not only did the political formula itself fail to represent the civic condominium that it was supposed to represent, had become basically a liability, and then international factors, regional factors influenced it to basically collapse, and thus we had the 1975-1990 civil war. The third of these principles is the autonomy of each community. Autonomy of each community in its own personal affairs. In other words, you have personal status laws, inheritance laws, weddings, divorces, deaths, all these things are the purview of each individual community. So the state would basically be only a registrar of births, but the religious community is the one that specifies that this new baby here belongs to such and such sect. So it's in that sense the religious community has found for themselves a little bit of say in their own personal affairs. And finally, the final, the last principle is that of mutual veto power between the different communities. And this obviously relates to the issue of the Grand Coalition. And to me, this is probably the most important thing that has and is and will govern Lebanese relations, Lebanese political relations between the different communities. That is, that each community, once it deems that any specific issue is detrimental to its own effects, it has the right to veto it anytime it wants to. And this obviously has, as Lebanon has developed, it has become more and more of a burden on this political system. Today we talk about Hezbollah, whether Hezbollah's actions are agreeable, whether they're not agreeable, whether the other forces are agreeing to this. It all falls from this specific issue of each community feels that it needs to make sure that its interests are protected in whatever other communities try to do. So this formula basically was survived between 1943 and 1975. And then for a while collapsed. And back in 1989, when the Lebanese met in Taif, Saudi Arabia, to sign the Taif Accords, that basically revived this formula. Except the major posts of government, you know, the Maronites still got the presidency, the Sunnis the prime ministership, and the Shiites the speakership of parliament. The only thing that changed there was the ratio of basically civil service and bureaucracy jobs and government posts and things like that between the different communities. According to the old formula, it was 6-5 in favor of the Christians. So every time six Lebanese Christians wanted to enter the army, they needed to tag along with five Lebanese Muslims. It was just like that. And civil service posts and members of parliament, there were always the last one before the Civil War, 99 member, 54 Christians, 45 Muslims, 6-5. What Taif did is divided them to 6-6, 50-50. But by then, things were looking different than they were back in 43 or back in 32. By then and now, we all know that actually from a point of view of number of people, that Muslims are much more numerous than Christians in Lebanon. They probably, latest estimates put them at about 54% of the population. And among those, the plurality goes to the Shia, who now form about 40% of the total population. So, unfortunately, no census has been taken. I doubt that that one will be taken. I don't think that that it's only the Mennonites who are going to not to allow that to happen. I think that also other religious communities are not going to let it happen. The Druze are not going to let it happen. Neither will the Sunnis let it happen, simply because if that happens and the Shia are discovered to be the largest plurality, maybe then they'll ask for the presidency. I don't think these the other communities will stand for that. So everybody is basically holding their horses on that issue. Part of that old political formula is that understanding, the old understanding between the different communities, that Lebanon is an Arab country, but also Lebanon reserves the right to look westward. And that is, it's an Arab country because historically it's an Arab country, but then the Lebanese Christians always wanted to make sure that they have some sort of a Western outlet, so to speak, somebody to protect them out west, and especially Mother France. And the 1989 Taif Accords basically put that to rest. Finally, the Lebanese supposedly signed on to a new formula where Lebanon is an Arab country, period. And mind you, at the time, the country was occupied by 30,000 Syrian soldiers. And in the 90s, Lebanon took that specific stand. Lebanon was an Arab country, and in all that it did, it was supposed to be only an Arab country, not looking out west. But in 2005, something bad happened. In 2004, something bad happened. Late Prime Minister Hariri got assassinated, and that led to Prime Minister Hariri died. But that led the communities to start asking, okay, what are we doing here with all these, finally, Syrian soldiers? And thus, the Syrian revolution and the Syrians leave. And the political formula starts to change a little bit. The Lebanese start to reevaluate that Arabness thing. And along with that evaluation of the Arabness thing is the issue of, instead of the Lebanese looking to the Arab hinterland, so to speak, they are also looking to the hinterland of that hinterland. I mean Iran. So when we're talking about the principle of consociationalism, with each religious community being afraid of the others, each one's losses, each one's gains is the other's losses, then everybody is trying to look at their cards. Everybody is trying will look at what is happening and why am I losing. And it just happens that this time the Shiites are winning, and they're winning in the name of Hezbollah. And they win in the name of Hezbollah, but guess what's happening with Walid Jumblat and his Druze community? Guess what's happening with the Maronite community? And guess what's happening among the elites of the Sunni communities? All of them are saying their gain is our loss. And thus, now everybody is, instead of talking about, this is one of those, I'm not making a claim to say, well, you know, Hezbollah won this war, hey, rah, rah, or Israel lost this war. I'm saying that in this specific atmosphere, Hezbollah stands 34 days against the onslaught, and according to Hezbollah in this community, it won. And what happens to the other religious minorities in Lebanon, the other religious communities? Their Hezbollah's gain is their loss. So thus, all these people are saying, well, you know, it's like they all want to congratulate their brother Hezbollah for not allowing the wolf to eat all the sheep, but yet they are criticizing him for opening the door to the barn. They're all thinking, well, rah, 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 we won, we did this, we did that. You know, Hezbollah really won this battle against Israel. But at the same time, why did Hezbollah do this? The country has been destroyed. And not only the country has been destroyed, its future is in jeopardy. And thus, obviously, the religious content of the political discourse comes to the fore right away. And this is why when we talk, when we hear about what's happening in Lebanon, when we hear about Hezbollah disarming or not disarming, when we hear about other religious communities talking about maybe Iran is here, is playing here, the Syrians are again trying to get into the country, the United States is trying to protect this new democracy against the onslaught of Hezbollah and Iran and Syria along. It becomes a religious issue right away because it just happens that the Hezbollah represents Shia, Walid Jumblatt represents his Druze, and Jaja and all the other Mennonite leaders represent their leaders, and Saad Hariri represents the Sunnah. So, again, going back to the issue of someone's gain is another's loss. Well, if this brings us basically to the concept of civic peace and religion within the country, within a country that really has seen way, way too much conflict in 3 decades. From what I look at, and very, very briefly, if this multi-religious Lebanon is to escape the reversion into full-scale civil war, not that anybody is talking about civil war anyway, the Lebanese are, I just came back about a month and a half from there, everybody is talking about there's no way we're going to shoot at each other again. There is no way. And to its credit, Hezbollah has not used its armament against any other Lebanese faction. But briefly speaking, what needs to be done very, very on a very, very basic scale is for Hezbollah to be aware that whatever glory it has secured over the last 1.5 months, it needs to allow for this sought-after state, the Lebanese state. The Lebanese state needs to be strengthened. It needs to allow that state to exist and to exercise its responsibilities as the sole legitimate monopolizer of power on its territory. To its credit, the Hezbollah has allowed the deployment of the Lebanese army in the south, and I hope that it goes to the next step of allowing this army to exercise full authority to help the state basically also legitimate its claim to being a state in this nation. Hezbollah, it behooves Hezbollah to allow the state to take on some of the social role that it needs to take on. Hezbollah has been absent. The state has been absent from southern Lebanon since 1965, 68, something like that. And not totally absent. Obviously, there are state services and the army drives by every once in a while. But as far as the religious, as the Shia community, the dominant community in the south, the state does not exist for them. Over the last 2.5 decades, they did it by themselves through their own political organizations, which is Hezbollah and Amal. And basically, they spend their own money on themselves, trying to do things for themselves. So I think the state would do well picking up that social role, not only the national role of being, you know, the protector of the country. For all other Lebanese parties, political parties, first of all, they should be careful about this paranoia. The issue is, I obviously don't agree with how they look at what the Lebanese system should be like, but they have this paranoia that Hezbollah's gain is their loss. As far as Hezbollah's pronouncements and actions since it has become what it is now, it really has not had any detrimental effect on any other political faction or any other political organization. In fact, it has, in its areas, at least done the state's work. It has done some good work. However, for everyone, perhaps now is the time that everyone started honestly talking about truly reforming the Lebanese political formula. This issue of someone's gain and is another loss is not going to work very much longer. It has worked so far, little by little, you know, every once in a while there is some sort of a hiccup on the, along the road, and some patchwork has been done, but it has not necessarily been the optimum agreement. I think that the political system needs to go to full secularization. Taif has the mechanisms within it. Taif calls for the creation of an upper house that represents the different communities, a la United States, you know, a Senate and a House, and a lower house that would represent people's voting, whatever. And that way the communities will be represented, the country will get on a better footing, so to speak, and then maybe civic peace would have a chance. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Imad. Just in closing, I want to make a few remarks to give a little more balance to what the situation is on the ground in terms of interfaith relations in the Middle East. We've elaborated today, and we know from the press the extent to which sharp religious differences exist and conflicts exist among religious groups. What is less well known is the degree of interfaith relations and dialogue that occurs. Lebanon, despite all its confessional tensions, has a very well-developed system of groups that facilitate and encourage and organize interfaith dialogue. The Arab Group for Muslim-Christian Dialogue, based in Beirut, works on a regional basis, and they have been partners with USIP on some of our activities in the Middle East. Jordan also has well-developed organizations and is a leader in interfaith dialogue. And some of it, in fact, much of it, is organized by the royal family. USIP has been intimately involved with the creation and the continued work of the Iraqi Institute of Peace. And the principal purpose of IIP is to work across the Sunni-Shia division. And with Shia leadership in IIP, some of their main activities have been to reach out to the Sunni community to encourage their involvement in the constitution writing process, to make sure that Sunni views are articulated and heard when decisions are made, and to promote interfaith peace primarily between those two communities. Dialogue between Muslims, Jews, and Christians in Israel and between Israel and the Palestinian territories is also quite extensive. A couple of years ago, we published a peace works by Yehezkel Landau, which is available on the table out there, called Healing the Holy Land, which describes many of these interfaith activities between Muslims, Christians, and Jews in Israel and Palestine. USIP has been heavily involved with the so-called Alexandria process in Israel-Palestine. Over the last 4 years, we've been the principal financial supporter of that process. Religious leaders at the highest levels coming together to advocate for peace and calling for religious peace. Early in, mid-2007, we'll be publishing a book by Muhammad Abu Nimr of American University and two of his American University colleagues on interfaith dialogue in the Middle East, a really important study that has looked at Lebanon, Jordan, Egypt, and Israel-Palestine, and documented on the basis of field research the kinds of interfaith activities that are underway and how interfaith work could be advanced in the future. It's easy to be excessively negative about religious conflict without recognizing the extent to which religious leaders in the region are reaching out across religious boundaries and trying to promote peace and understanding among religious communities. I want to join you in thanking our presenters, and we have a microphone over here. If you're interested in making a comment or asking a question, you can line up behind the microphone, and we will take your questions and comments in turn. Yes.
Al Milliken, Washington Independent Writers. When in Middle Eastern cultures, there are historic memories of glory and power, whether it is a greater Syria or a Babylonian or Persian Empire, or the extent that Islam or Christianity has spread and developed to what extent is religion promoting and celebrating or warning and spreading caution about the possibilities and realities of recapturing past glory and power in the future?
Well, Graham, you want to?
I'll take a start at the question anyway. I'm not sure I fully understand the full range of what you're trying to get at, but I think religion serves many different purposes, as you know, and when the glories of the past can be marshaled to justify present policies or future aspirations, then I think we very quickly see it. This is true of every country, every civilization in the world. You try to rest your future glory on the basis of past glory. But I don't think that necessarily has to be negative or exclusive. But today, as I suggested in my opening remarks, what if there were no Islam, that there is groundwork for a great deal of resentment in the region as a Middle East against the West, then I think you find people grabbing for banners to exemplify that cause. And if you have an Islam, it's easier to have that flag, to raise the Islamic flag to justify what your struggles or grievances are in the Middle East, just as the West at least in the past, it would grab towards a Christian flag to represent itself, or indeed some Israelis embracing or using Judaism as the justification for the Israeli state. I'm not sure that fully answers your question, but I'm not sure I also fully understood all that you were getting at. Do you have any?
Yes.
Lucia Worthington with the University of Maryland. I appreciate your overview of the religious traditions in the Middle East. And I'm also curious as to why you have not really addressed the issue of when you're looking at Sunni and Shia now that we are in Iraq and we are really backing a Shia faction. How does that affect, because we in fact took out a Sunni government and now we have a Shia faction dominated government in Iraq. So how does that work now? And
how does it work?
How does that work for the United States? It seems to me it puts us in a precarious position, especially when we use terms such as Islamic fascism.
You want to, Daoud?
Actually, what happened now in Lebanon, this latest encounter with Hezbollah, has bridged the gap. If you notice what Hezbollah has done, and Hezbollah is reputed as being probably the only organization that extends support to the resistance in Palestine, in Israel. It is almost a natural ally of the Hamas and jihad groups in Israel. So on the whole, this division between Sunni and Shia has been bridged by Hezbollah almost uniquely in the Arab world, and it portrays a national liberation movement under a religious umbrella, so to speak.
Go ahead.
Just one quick addition on that. I don't think the U.S. intention was to actually just bring Shia to power. Obviously, if you look at the demographics of it, you knew that the Shia would probably be the dominant force. But Washington's goal, I think, was to bring a friendly, grateful regime to power, which I'm not sure they got. And even if we did, in fact, were the instrument of bringing the Shia to power via electoral process, I would not want to bet on Shia gratefulness or pro-Americanness down the road.
And in addition, I think even before the war, those who were assessing possible outcomes could have seen that Iran was going to be a principal beneficiary of Shia ascendance in Iraq, with considerable influence over whatever group came to power. It was going to be a Shia majority, and with so many of the Shia leadership having been based in Iran, been trained in Iran, having close ties, the militias having been financed and armed by Iran, it wasn't too hard to anticipate that there would be a very significant Iranian influence coming out of a Shiite ascendancy in Iraq. Yes.
Hi, my name is Roya Sterner. I'm a graduate student at George Washington University. Just Mr. Fuller wanted to ask if you could elaborate on when you said Mr. Rabin admitted to Arafat that supporting, I think it was
Hamas
against Arab nationalists was the greatest mistake we ever made. If you could just elaborate.
First of all, I'm embarrassed that I cannot recall the exact place that I read this, but it was fairly recently. In fact, a book came out in the last, my memory is slipping, there's too much going on in the world. But a book has come out in the last year or two talking about, I think, some of the backgrounds on Hamas. In any case, yeah, I mean, it was well known that Israel perceived correctly at the time, perceived that that the Muslim Brotherhood, put it that way, and the Hamas, there was a Muslim Brotherhood for Palestine, and Hamas was created out of that Muslim Brotherhood in Palestine to actually become involved in guerrilla warfare and become a political party in the way that the Muslim Brotherhood did not feel was appropriate for itself in its own name, so that Hamas was created out of the Brotherhood to fight that particular struggle. But prior to that time, as I said, the Muslim Brotherhood had been highly opposed to Arab nationalism, to Nasser, to communism. They didn't like the PLO. The PLO was seen as a leftist organization. And for that reason, Israel supported the creation of Hamas. It didn't create it, but I mean, it looked the other way and found it a positive development as a way to fight the leftist PLO secular, to fight the secular Palestinian struggle, which, as I said, also included Christian. One of the major terrorist guerrilla organizations, the PFLP, was under the leadership of a Christian, George Habash. So anyway, at that time, it was this idea of any stick to beat a dog, and Hamas was the stick that Israel found useful to back against the PLO. Rabin later allegedly commented, and even if I believe the comment that was made, but many, many Israelis have said, gee, that wasn't maybe such a good idea. It's one of the many times when one or another state has backed Islamists to fight someone else, only then to find that the Islamists themselves have become very powerful.
Yes.
Carl Osgood with Executive Intelligence Review. Mr. Fuller, you began your remarks talking about the impact of the United States, what the U.S. does on that region. Part of what the U.S. does is it has designated Hezbollah and Hamas as terrorist groups, which obviously has an effect on our policy. I don't see how we're going to ever get to a comprehensive peace without talking to people like that. So I wonder if you could address how that designation affects our behavior and the result of that in the region.
Sure, I'd be happy to, and I hope my colleagues here at the table will also contribute if any thoughts they have on this. Let me be blunt. I think the United States is now heading for disaster in the Middle East. We're not headed for it. We're there. We're in disaster in the Middle East, and I don't see that that the situation is getting better anywhere and probably worsening along all of these lines. Part of the problem, I think, has been in the legitimate struggle against international terrorism and especially al-Qaeda that the administration began with. It now has come to embrace anybody and everybody who has ever used force and violence in the name of any armed struggle or liberation struggle or resentments against it. I don't want to say that, I mean, killing is killing, is always bad, but that goes for armies as well as it is for terrorist organizations. And it's difficult to say one terrorist organization is better or worse than another. But the fact is that Hamas, Hezbollah, the Chechens, and any a number of other movements have, national liberation movements, have very clear, finite, soluble, answerable goals that I would argue some kind of negotiation or other could ultimately deal with, in a way that you can't sit down with Al-Qaeda, because Al-Qaeda has these cosmic, global vision of what the problem is. So I think to lump them all together has enabled every single country in the world to take their chosen armed opposition and throw them into the terrorist category, which means that we're opposed to every single movement in the world that has, that employs political violence at all, which is impossible for us to do. So yes, in short, I would argue if we're going to get anywhere in the Middle East in the future, we have got to start talking to everybody. We're now not able to talk to anybody that, with whom we have trouble. We can't talk to the Iranians. We functionally don't talk to the Syrians anymore. And we can't talk to Hamas or deal with them, even though they're the elected government. And we can't talk to Hezbollah, which is the most important group in Lebanon. So we are quite isolated and out of the loop, I fear, with a blunt military instrument as the sole diplomatic sole tool in our toolbox to face this deteriorating situation.
Yes.
My name is Mary Mullen. I wanted to ask about the United States in that area as well. And they seem to only, with Israel, only support the army with their $2.2 billion a year toward military, for the Israeli military. And I go oftentimes to the Palestine Center, and the Israeli human rights groups are very outspoken for the rights of both the Israelis and the Palestinians. There are many people in the Knesset that speak out on behalf of Palestinians as well, more than we do here. We don't do that here, and our human rights groups don't speak out as well as the Israeli human rights groups do. But we don't support them. We only seem to support just the Israeli army. And I was wondering, am I just in the clouds somewhere? But it seems that these groups could be quite effective if we gave them some support, and we don't seem to.
Now, which groups are you suggesting support for? The
Israeli human rights groups, mm-hmm. The Israeli politicians that do speak out on behalf of Palestinians, that we give them some support and some understanding. We just seem to only support the Israeli army under any condition and every condition. It seems that we don't really criticize them in any way. I'm just wondering whether I'm in the clouds or whether this could be done.
Sure. Well, again, I don't want to be the sole speaker up here. I hope some of my colleagues will join me on this, but I think you're absolutely correct, and your head is not in the clouds. I am ashamed when I look at the U.S. press and mainstream media, I should say, in general, in its non-coverage of issues or poor coverage or biased coverage, not just of Arab-Israeli, but the entire world. I mean, these days, if you want to be well-informed, you have to read a broad variety of international press and non-mainstream media in this country that formerly was seen as somewhat marginal or fringe. And today, blogs as well are part of it. Israel is magnificent in its willingness to debate these issues. There are trenchant criticisms of Israel, of the United States, interesting and insightful analyses of the region. This is not to say all of the Israeli press, but certainly the liberal Israeli press is filled with this kind of thing that the United States press dares not. I mean, I don't even, the New York Times, the Washington Post would not dare publish half the articles that appear in Haaretz which is one of the biggest newspapers in Israel of all, would never dare republish these articles written by Jews living in Israel and commenting on this. So I think we're in a very, very dangerous situation here, that we will not allow ourselves to examine the full range of reality for whatever many reasons. It isn't just Israel. It's much broader than that. And that's why I fear for the state of our policies and our nation at this point.
And our Congress, I just wanted to mention, when I go to congressional hearings in the Middle East, if someone's bringing up the Palestinian side, Congress really doesn't give them much of a chance. I mean, our Congress, yeah. And it makes me ashamed that this is a democracy, I thought, yeah. And they should at least give them a go.
Well, if you want to make a case, I would argue everybody in this room to arm yourselves with commentary and cover and reporting from the Israeli press, and bring that in, because it's first rate, it's objective. I mean, as much as any press can be objective, I think it's very cutting edge, insightful, and desperately needs to be heard in this country.
Daoud.
I would like to add also that it is to the credit of the human rights intelligentsia in Israel that they have exhibited much more moral courage than we see generally in this country. It is definitely to their credit, and it is really a bad omen for us here when we have so many taboos that they don't have even inside of Israel.
Yes.
My name is Ziad Hafez. I'm an independent consultant. I have two sets of questions. One is for Mr. Smock and one is for Dr. Ferrella. Mr. Smock, the title of this presentation is about the religious dimension of what is happening in the Middle East. Don't you think that a title like this is a reflection of a trend in this country and in the West in general to try to couch the narrative of political events in the Arab world or in the Middle East, or for that matter of fact in the rest of the world also, in cultural terms rather in pointing out to the raw facts of political ambition, economic issues, political issues, and things like that, and to state the difference in terms of cultural differences rather than in terms of pedestrian interests? And my question for Mr. Ferrella is, I have two questions. One, what are the factors that you think are the most relevant in explaining the success of Hezbollah on the political arena in Lebanon? And do you think, and would you agree or disagree with what Dr. Hart has suggested, that the success is necessarily going to be a loss for someone else, and what should be done in order to get out of this zero-sum game in the Lebanese political setup?
I would agree with your premise in your first question, and in organizing this workshop today, we definitely didn't want to be communicating our conviction that religion is the most important factor. Rather, it is lifted up in the press and popular discourse so often as either the most important or among the most important factors that we felt it would be helpful to examine that, the extent to which religion is at the source of the various conflicts in the Middle East. And I hope we conveyed our own sense that while religious groups identified with a particular religion may be in conflict with each other, it isn't so much a religious conflict as it is a conflict among ethnic or identity groups. So I would accept the premise of your question. Daoud?
Yeah. My answer to the first question, which is the factors of success for Hezbollah, I can think of two. First, their integrity and moral standing on the issues. If you take almost their standing from any issue, they are transparent and they have adopted a certain level of honesty and integrity, speaking the truth, that their opponents, their enemies, recognize this for them. And this is, in my judgment, is a very, very important factor. It is an important factor. It raises the morale of the members of the party, and it gives them a certain credibility throughout. And whether their success would lead to a zero-sum game, I think, in general, in this confessional system in Lebanon seems to be governed by this theory that whoever gets certain rights, certain advantages, certain privileges would be taking these advantages and privileges from other communities. They seem to have a vision that go a little bit beyond this, and that's what accounts for their popularity, not only in Lebanon, but throughout the Arab world. So I think their integrity in general and the farsight is something that worked well for their successes.
I have one more question for Mr. Harb.
Okay.
Dr. Harb, you've made this the statement that Hezbollah should step back and allow the state to grow and to be developed. And given the premises of your presentation that in Lebanon you have some form of a consensual system where the communities have to agree on what is good and what is not good, how do you think a state can take place when you have the veto power of one community if it believes that the gain of someone will be the loss of someone else? And therefore, don't you think that all over the past 50 years or 6 years since independence, the fact that a state has not been erected in Lebanon is due to the fact that you have a sectarian system that will prevent it as long as it exists from building a state?
Well, that's a good question. I'm looking for basically ways of putting away this formula of someone's gain is another's loss. I'm thinking that Hezbollah can count on the victory that it can negotiate from a position of strength, but at the same time I have no doubts whatsoever that the others are going to be negotiating thinking that Hezbollah will try to get as much leverage out of its victory as possible. I, however, think that both need to be, cooler heads eventually prevail. And it's, in the Lebanese case, cooler heads have always prevailed, despite the fact that they have driven the country into ruins many times. I'm hoping that cooler heads will now prevail to allow cooler heads on Hezbollah's part and cooler heads on the opponents of Hezbollah, that they would say that maybe a good compromise is that compromise that takes away a little bit from Hezbollah but doesn't give it to them, the opponents of Hezbollah, gives it to the central state. Hezbollah has acted like a state. For all intents and purposes, in the south, Hezbollah was the state. In Baalbek, I was in Baalbek a month and a half ago, you couldn't go anywhere without knowing that there is Hezbollah around. The Lebanese state is not there. In the south, is the same thing. I think that Hezbollah will be able, given that it has got itself the victory that it really fought for, that it can position itself in such a way as not only to be a political organization that would help the state to establish itself, that would help the state to be the influential, effective state, the strong state that it's supposed to be. And Lebanon cannot be governed the way it has been governed since 1943. This issue of the community is being more powerful than the central state. And Hezbollah is not the reason. This was way, way before Hezbollah. And the people who are now calling for the strong state, back in the 50s and 60s, didn't want the strong state, because if the strong state had existed, they would not have had that power that they want. So I think that everybody will have the right incentives, the good incentives, and the incentive to try to establish a third leverage, a third position, a third center of gravity, so to speak, and that would be the state. I mean, that's the only way to go. You can't allow Hezbollah to be the more powerful than this rate. You can't allow the state to just simply not exist, because there are other communities other than Hezbollah. That's the only way to go.
Father McLean.
Thank you, Professor McLean from Catholic University and the Council for Research in Values and Philosophy. I would like to pick up on your first question and perhaps come with a different answer than David suggested. That is, I would think that the cultural issue is, in fact, very important and very fundamental. We go back to the events of Westphalia, et cetera, and we drop a line between religion and everything else. And so we don't recognize that religion is a factor. I think it took us years to recognize that the Iranian Revolution really was a religious revolution. Very interesting that you came up with a list of people that we don't talk to. Why can we not talk with them? We cannot talk with them because they all have a religious commitment. And when you mentioned then, of course, the series of things which are negotiable, they're not working, especially in terms of pragmatism. They're not working in terms of the utilitarian vision that is common in the West. And so our inability to talk with anybody that has a commitment, which is the religious character of Islam, then I think is the reason why we can, in fact, or do not talk with all of the people that we're having trouble with. Perhaps we're having trouble with them precisely because we cannot recognize their culture, we cannot recognize their commitment, we cannot honor their religious commitment. That might be the very important thing. I taught for a month in Qom, and I noticed there the elements that move them, that they're committed to, that they're able to negotiate, and on what basis they do that. I think they can talk very well on religious basis, but if you dismiss their religion and then try to work on a utilitarian, pragmatic political negotiation, then it's, I think, a radically unsuccessful thing. Sistani, I think, our biggest help in Iraq is precisely the committed religious person. We went in, I think, not wanting to talk with him. He doesn't particularly want to talk with us. But Sistani, I think, if there has been any saving element for lives, American lives and others in Iraq, it's been Sistani. We need to know how to talk to that. We need to know how to build on that. That would be my suggestion. It would take a somewhat different orientation than first question and the more hands-off, you might say, suggestion of David Smock, which is...
I didn't mean to suggest hands-off in terms of lack of communication, but I would question whether our unpreparedness to speak to Iran, to Hezbollah, to Hamas is because they're Muslim or have Islamic convictions. There are other factors, too, that have led to those policy positions. I do agree with you that we've had great difficulty understanding religious discourse and communicating with people whose motivations are largely religious in the political sphere, and we should certainly learn to do that.
Yeah. I think that term that one hears about and in prominent places of Islamo-fascist wants to say that. What does fascism mean here? Fascism means that there's a leadership that is not elected. Can we live with that? If we cannot live with that, then we're going to have to face a lot of fighting.
You want to say something?
I would like to take a shot at this. Uh-huh. I think we are betraying our own Western values when we neglect important issues. It is not the fact that we have to consider any idiosyncrasies in every other group. It is to remain faithful to our own principles, and this is where we are not doing well. Fundamental issues of justice, even by Western standards, require a little different position on the part of our governments. And this is where we find ourselves lacking. This is where we find ourselves, like, we attribute to some religious idiosyncrasies anything that would help us deviate or get away from what we consider basic Western principles. And basically, we know that rule of law is something that is common at international level, that governs universally the human community. We know that laws change from one community to the other, but we know that there are certain general principles that should apply equally to everyone. And these principles, we don't always apply them equally to everyone.
Thank you.
Lauren Smith from the U.S. Joint Forces Command in Norfolk. As Ode was talking, I was reminded as he traced the Hezbollah growth back to the formation and the process of the basic tenets of Shiism. And that, of course, is the strong emphasis on stewardship. And that also then reminded me, as the doctor has brought up, of two Iranian revolutions which followed the same path for the same reasons. So I would ask the panel this question, given that you're reading media somewhere where there is media to read. Do you see perhaps an intellectual backlash going toward the patron of Hezbollah as a result of their purity in doing what Shia traditionally are to do, and the contrast between the old guard or fighting the young guard in a country that can't feed itself and can't get a job?
Could you just reformulate that last sentence again?
In other words, in Iran,
yes,
which went through two revolutions for the same purpose, the second being placed on honorable tenets, both of which were based on the Shia faith, we now see young revolutionaries, Shia, in another place, doing what Shia are supposed to do, theoretically, and is their success, as was described by Daoud, in social programs, in supporting people, in their stewardship, in their faith, causing others to look back at their patron, who will only send words and guns, rockets?
I'll start. I think we all have some comments I make on this. Yeah, I think you raise a very important issue. Certainly, we have a tired Islamic revolution in Iran that has not been fully successful in terms of its own goals in bringing full transformation or full democratization of that country. And as you're absolutely correct, that there's a great deal of youthful discontent with just tired autocrats in the system. It's not an autocratic system, but it's still very heavy-handed in its approach. But I think right now, sadly, the situation has deteriorated so much in the Middle East over a very long period of time that I think there is a craving in much of the region, Sunnis and Shia, for any power that will stand up and defend the Muslim world, defend, in their view, the cause of justice, the stand up for Islam in the face of a Western onslaught, that it, I think Iran gets a lot of credit, even by people who don't like Persians and don't like Iran very much, who will say, you know, we don't like Persians much, but by God, these people are doing something right. They got rid of, you know, they got rid of the Shah, which was the U.S. main ally in the region. They have been willing to say things, some good, some not so good, about this, what's going on in the region, that I think people who feel downtrodden and unrepresented and without voice in their country find very exciting. Even Iran now gets some strong benefit from this. Not regimes. Regimes in the Middle East are very frightened of Iran and of Hezbollah because of the revolutionary and democratic and outspoken bold assertiveness of these regimes. So regimes are scared, but I think most people, most publics are not, except where they're engaged in their own, like in Iraq, engaged in their own local neighborhood Sunni Shia struggles, where they do see it. That's just the beginning of an answer, and I'm sure my colleagues will have some.
No, I'd like to point to an issue that is quite prevalent as a basis for Hezbollah and Hezbollah's operation, modus of operation. And this goes back to some kind of a division of the world between oppressor and oppressed, al-mustakbirin wal-mustadafin. And this division, if you want, this dichotomy, goes back to Khomeini when he was a teacher in Najaf. And many of the Hezbollah leaders were students of that teacher. Now, this concept is to be distinguished from the general concept that you have Dar al-Islam, the dwelling of Islam, and Dar al-Harb, the land of war where the non-Muslim live, which basically divides Muslim from non-Muslim. In this formula, the mustadafin and mustakbirin, the oppressed and the oppressor, it would probably be closer to a Marxist division than otherwise, and it goes beyond the concept that all the mustadafin are Muslim, all the oppressed are Muslim. This is not the case. Neither all the oppressors are non-Muslim. So there is a humanitarian dimension in this respect, and this is where the moral foundation of the Hezbollah lies in many of their political discourses. And this is where, this is how they justify, for example, they consider the occupation, land occupation, is the ultimate form of oppression. And this is why they put Israel in the rubric of the enemy, because they look at the occupation of Lebanon and what happened, and the occupation of Palestine and what happens. And in this formula, they interpret, if you want, and they still interpret to a large extent. Now, this principle, this idiom, if you want, might or might not be very operational among the Iranian leadership. It's a different story, but this is basically a fundamental guideline for Hezbollah.
One additional point is you know, Iran doesn't do this because it just likes the Shia of Lebanon or likes the you know, the Christians of Uganda or any. Every state does this. I mean, the Iranians are not doing it only on a religious basis. They're not doing it only because they are the standard bearers of modern Shiaism. Iran is doing it from, you know, his own death. It's one of those things that states do. I mean, you know, the Shah did it with the Kurds of Iraq against Saddam Hussein, and vice versa. You know, the United States is doing it with Israel. I mean, the United States did it with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in the 1980s. So states do this, and it doesn't have to be necessarily because they are trying to do the good deed, you know, the Shia style. It's the states do that. I don't think that Iran has that messianic vision that it's only doing the messianic thing. It also has the reasons of state, that states do this because they get a gain out of it. And guess what? Iran gained from the latest conflagration. I mean, and they do it. They do it all the time.
Okay. We'll have the last question.
This Al Milliken, WIW again. When human shields are being used, or when military and terrorist operations deliberately use holy and civilian areas to be based or to place important military operations and weapons, how is Islam responding to this kind of warfare? As I understand Christian just war theory, this is problematic because there should not be a deliberate targeting of civilians or non-combatants. But isn't this part of the effectiveness of those who want to promote terror yet protect themselves without concern for those who are not trying to fight?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not a military tactician, but Hezbollah probably used. They did the nefarious things. They launched their weapons from civilian areas. Yes, you know, South Lebanon is a place of a lot of civilians, but guess what? Israeli military bases are also in civilian areas. I mean, everybody does that. Everybody does it. I mean, and to tell you the truth, I mean, you know, I am not a supporter of Hezbollah. I'd rather them not be there in the first place. I'd rather they don't have their own messianic visions of everything. But I want them to be secularists. But at the same time, if you have a 500-pound bomb that is laser-guided, I just don't understand why you wouldn't hit that specific missile launcher and not the school next door. It's that kind of thing. I mean, it's if we either fight a war that is clean or we don't complain about anybody being in civilian areas. I mean, you know, if you go to Alexandria, go to what's the fort in Alexandria, or whatever it's being. If anybody wants to attack the United States and hit civilian areas around there, they'll tell you, well, this fort was in civilian areas. It happens all the time, and we must be, whether it is Hezbollah or Israel. They both should have been more circumspect about their targeting. Unfortunately, I mean, this target practice took civilians. It didn't take military targets.
Well, if you take the number of casualties inflicted by both sides, Israelis on Lebanese civilians and Hezbollah on Israeli civilians, I think it will be a strange equation that the large majority of the Israeli victims are military, and the overwhelming majorities of the Hezbollah victims,
Lebanese.
The Lebanese victims, are civilians. So when you look at this equation, it is a little bit strange that this terrorist organization is a little bit more careful, it seems, than what the Israelis, who have precision and laser-guided bombs and all that, have inflicted. Definitely, war is dirty, but the record is not really one-sided, especially that when we know that Hezbollah, ever since 1996, they concluded an agreement where the civilians were to be protected. And Hezbollah seems to have, and they have on several occasions, its leaders said, don't attack our civilians, we'll stop our rockets in your directions. But notwithstanding that, the majority of the Israeli casualties are militaries, and the overwhelming majorities of the Lebanese casualties are civilians.
Just one more footnote on just war theology or theory. It's not only Christianity that has a just war position, but Islam similarly has a just war that's articulated in somewhat different terms and different form. But contrary to what Islamic extremists are saying, that the killing of civilians in armed action is proscribed in Islam just as it is in Christianity. Well, our time is up, and I want to thank you for coming, but I particularly want to thank our panelists today.